It was a couple of years ago that I was sitting in a church, and I was just one of the people in the congregation. And as I was sitting there, the pastor looked down at me, and he said, "I see that Florence Littauer is in our audience this morning." He said, "I think it would be nice if we had her come up front and say a few words." Now, for some of you, that might be a shock to be called forward to say a few words spontaneously. For me, I have never been at a loss for words, and I never mind being brought forth to say a few words. So I got out of my seat and started up the aisle. As I started up the aisle, he looked down and he said, "In fact, why don't we have Florence do the children's sermon this morning?" Now, I had not ever done a children's sermon. I had never felt that the Lord had called me to the children, but that had basically called me to adults and to working with people with personality difficulties or ones that needed to have a stronger motivation in life, who needed to get to know the Lord Jesus in a personal way, and I felt this had been my call. So as I was coming up the aisle, I thought of just saying to him, "I don't do children's sermons." But then as soon as that thought came to me, I realized I couldn't say that because I was there in this man's church to teach the other people how to be speakers spontaneously. So I thought certainly I would be a poor witness if on the way up the aisle I said, "I don't do that." So I, as coming up, all this was going through my mind. And as I was coming, trying to figure out what I was going to do with this situation, I noticed that little children were coming out of all the aisles. I mean, he had little children coming up front. They were used to this. They knew what happened every week. And all of the children came up front so that by the time I got to the front, there was this whole group of children in front of me. Now, this was the kind of church, and I don't know about yours, but it was the kind of church where people got there early in order that they could sit in the back and not have to be near the front. So the whole front of the church was empty. So I had these little children and then lots of empty pews before there were people way back there. So as I looked at this little group, I thought to myself, what am I going to say to them? Well, I think most of us, if we know one verse in life, we know more than 90% of the people we're going to run into. So I thought, right off, a verse. I'll teach them a verse. The verse that came to my mind immediately was a verse that we had used with our children, a verse that we had taught our children around the dinner table, that we had used as pretty much of a rule for our life. And the verse is Ephesians 4:29. "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers." Now, I was excited when that came to me, that I can teach that to children. And as soon as the idea came to me, I thought, but those are big words. How are they going to learn those big words? So all of this is going through my mind, and it's now time for me to start. So I said to them this morning, we're going to look at one verse today. I'm going to teach you one verse. And before you leave today, you're going to know this one verse. And I said, anytime you look at a verse, you want to ask yourself three things. One, what does it say? And then I gave them the verse, what it said. Secondly, what does it mean in the context of the scripture? And thirdly, how does it apply to you and me today? So I said, let's look at it from that point of view. So I shared it with them again, that the verse says, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers." And they all looked wide-eyed, and they said, like, oh. And I said, "Do you think you can understand that?" Oh, they didn't know if they could understand that or not. I said, well, let's look at where it came from in the scripture. It's Paul. And at this point, Paul is speaking to the people in Ephesus, and he's telling them that he's heard that the people in the church are saying nasty words about each other. And they all looked wide-eyed, and I said, can you believe these good people in the church would say bad words to each other? They know. They couldn't believe that. And I said, but sometimes that happens. People don't say kind things to one another, even in church. And so I said, let's look at it. That's what Paul was saying. And I said, now, if that church in those days really had kind, loving, gentle, compassionate people, Paul wouldn't have had to write this letter. So the fact that he had to write and say it means there was a problem. So, oh, yes, they could see that. So I said, now how does it apply to you and me today? I said, let's take this verse apart and see what it says to you and me. Let's start it right at the beginning. It says, let no corrupt communication. I said, now what is corrupt communication? Oh, they didn't know. Those were big words. And I said, that's right, but think about it for a minute. What's communication? Well, we came up with talking. What would corrupt communication be? Well, that would be bad talking. I said, that's right. What is bad talking? Well, bad talking is swearing, vulgar language. One little boy spoke up and he said, being nasty to your mother. said, that's right, don't do that, that's bad. And they all agreed, that was bad to do, we shouldn't try that one. And we went on and they pulled out little things, what it meant, all kinds of bad things to say. Then I said, all right, that's what the verse says we are not to do. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of whose mouth? And they said, our mouth. I said, that's right. That's what the verse is talking to you. The verse is not just talking to those people in Ephesus that Paul wrote to. This verse is talking to you and me today, right here, that Paul is saying to us, and the Lord is speaking to us through this verse and saying we're not to say bad words to one another. I said, now that's what we shouldn't do. Now let's look and see what should we do. So it says that we should let no corrupt communication proceed out of our mouths, but that which is good. I said, you all know what good means? Oh, yes, good. They knew good. I said, good to the use of edifying. What does edifying mean? Well, they look kind of wide about that. That's a big word. And then one of the boys said, build up. I said, that's right, build up. That our words are supposed to build up other people. So we talked about this, and I was so delighted with the answers they gave me that I decided I should have been speaking to children all along. Their response is so fresh and wide-eyed. They have no guile about them. So as I asked them, I said, what does it mean, building up somebody else? What kind of a word builds up? And as they told me different words, a little boy spoke up, and he said, you mean that our words should be like building blocks? I thought, that's good. Building blocks. Picture our words. Every word is like another block on top of a good block, on top of a good block. We're building, building, building. I said, that's right. Our words should be like building blocks. And as I was getting close to euphoric over this thought of building blocks for my words, one little girl spoke up and she said, and we shouldn't go around and knock other people's blocks down. That's right. I thought, that's right. That's right. And sometimes, and I can tell you recognize this possibility, that there are times that some of us go around and knock other people's blocks down. Now, see, what we're supposed to do is build them up, not go along and knock them down. And yet when you think about your words as building blocks, and that some people have come along and built them up for you, there's always that person that comes along, that proverbial blockbuster that comes along and your blocks are gone. And all the good things everybody said to you all day are wiped out because that one thing knocked your blocks down. Then I went on to the next part of it. It says, not only is it good to the use of edifying, but it is to minister grace. Now, that's heavy stuff for little children, minister grace. So what does it mean, minister grace? Somebody had taken a class somewhere that said that grace was God's unmerited favor. So this little child spoke out, God's unmerited favor. I was amazed at the size of this child that they knew that little phrase. They didn't have any idea what it meant, but they knew the word. Somebody taught it to them. So I said, all right, that's good. That's wonderful. That means that God has given us a favor. That's what grace is. So if I'm to give you grace, I'm to do you a favor. So now how could I do you a favor? Well, we went from favor into present, into gift, and then we came up with, yes, every word that comes out of my mouth should be like a present. I should give you a present with my words. That as I open my mouth, what should come out is that it should be a gift to you. You should be able to reach out and take my words and put them inside of you. And they should make you feel good. They should be a present to you, a gift. And I went on with that for a while with them. And as I did, one little girl, and I'll never forget this little precious child, she stood up at the end of the row. She turned to all the people. And she said to them, what she means is. Amazing. Amazing how a little child will interpret it so the adults can understand. And she said, what she means is that our words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. I looked at her and I said, that's right. That's what our words should be. That we should think of it like that. When our words come out, they should be like little silver boxes with a bow on top. Now, I loved what she said. It stayed in my mind, and I'll never forget, even though I have no idea what that little child's name was, but I'll never forget her saying, what she means is, your words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. That was 2 or 3 years ago that happened. I did nothing else with that because I haven't given a children's sermon since. Never before, never since. Never quite been called on it for that again. However, I'll never forget that morning. Last year, just a year ago, November, I spoke here in Florida, and one of you came up and identified yesterday that you were there that night I spoke. I spoke in Calvary Assembly Church, and in Winter Park, and as I spoke there that evening, I took the idea of that little silver box with the bow on top, and I used it to give a message on encouraging words. And as I gave it that night, I told about that little girl and about how she said what she means is that our words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. The next night, I was there for three evenings in a row. The next night, a lady came up to me and she gave me this little silver box. Now, this is a replacement, but this is exactly the same little silver box. She said, I was out today looking for ornaments for my Christmas tree. And she said, I was in the store and I saw that they had these ornaments, little silver boxes with a bow on top. She said, I bought this for you. She said, here it is. I'd like you to take it home, put it on your Christmas tree. And when you look at that, you'll think about that your words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. I was grateful for that, and I have carried it with me and carried it so that I could think myself of my word and what I'm saying to other people. Because the Lord has called me to be an encourager to other people, to show people who don't think they've got anything to say that, yes, they do. God can use your story of your life. God can use what you've got to say in sharing it with other people. So I want to always give encouraging words, little silver boxes with a bow on top. That same night, another lady came up to me. She brought a large silver box with a bow on top, too big to carry with me. She brought this large box along, and she said to me, she's a very strong lady, and as she walked up to me in the foyer of the church before I'd started that second evening, she said to me, last night I went home from here, and I realized when I got home that I had not said a nice word to my husband in years. Now, just the way she said it, I could tell she probably hadn't. Standing right behind her was a teenage daughter. The daughter looked over her mother's shoulder in dismay that the mother had even said this to me. And as I caught the daughter's eye, the daughter looked at me and she went, And she was telling me, Mother is right. She has not said a nice word. And then the mother went on to say, in fact, I haven't even said anything very nice to my children. And the girl then almost fell apart. I mean, she nodded to me like this. That is for sure. She said, so what happened last night when I got home? I thought about your message. And I realized that somehow I had to remind myself that my words were supposed to be silver boxes with bows on top. She said, so I went downtown today. She says, I bought a whole roll of silver paper. So I went out in the garage and I brought in some empty boxes left over from last Christmas. I wrapped them up in silver paper, got big bows on top, and she had one of them in her hand. And she said, I have put one of these boxes in every room in my house so that when I enter every room, I'll see that silver box and I'll remember that my words are to be like a silver box with a bow on top. That same night, I had a little boy come up to me. A little boy named Jason, he handed me this note. I've just kept this note with me ever since. A little note. Now, this boy is 10 years old. And he wrote me this note, and it says, Florence, God loves you. I love you. You really touched me last night. I will watch my words from here on. Love, Jason, 10 years old. Since then, I have used that letter as a demonstration, as I'm doing with you here today. And I spoke recently at another church, and there was a little boy named Jason, and he ripped out a piece of paper, and he gave me this little note, and this little note just says, I love you, Jason, from Jason, and it has hearts on it. And he handed it to me, and he said, I want you to have another note from a Jason. And so I thanked him for that. Then I had, when I used this, a little while ago, I used this, the original box, and I had used it as a demonstration up front as I've used it today. And afterwards, this adorable little boy, little sad-faced boy, and he came up to me up front after I was through speaking. And he looked up at me and he said, I want your box. And I looked at him and my first reaction is probably what yours might have been, I don't know. I said, no, I can't give you this box. I said, this is important to me. This is a special box to me. I can't give that to you. And as I was saying the words, it was like the Lord said to me, Florence, you can get another box. If this boy needs a silver box, give it to him. I can't tell you how it hurt me to pass that box across to that boy. Because I'd become attached to that box. It was important to me. But I handed him the box. And I said, all right. I said, I'll give you this box on one condition. He said, what's that? Little boy, 7 years old. And he said, what's that? I said, that you take it home and you put it on your dresser in your room. And you leave it there and you look at it every day. And you don't throw it away or give it away or lose it, but you put it right somewhere where you can look at it. And that way, every morning when you wake up, you can look at that little box. And you can realize as you walk out to breakfast, as you look at your mother, that you'll find out that your words will come out better, that they'll be like little silver boxes with bows on top. He clutched that little box, and the next night I got a letter, and it says, it had my name spelled out, and it says, I love you, and your message really touched me, and I thank you for your little silver box. And then a little picture of a silver box on the bottom. Now, I don't know whether that child has still got that silver box on his dresser, but I can tell you today that when he went out, that look on his face was precious. Isn't it amazing how a simple little tool, a simple little model, a little demonstration can make us realize and remember that our words should be like a little silver box with a bow on top. The world is not waiting for your criticism. The world is not waiting for you to knock someone's box down. The world is waiting. Your Christian world, your own world, your family world, and the world are all waiting for you to come out with little silver boxes with bows on top. As I began to use this message, I sent it out a year ago for my Christmas letter. I sent out a message that maybe this year, instead of giving lavish Christmas gifts, we should tell our friends and family that we don't have a lot of physical gifts for them this year, but we're going to give them a promise that for the coming year, we will, every time we see them, give them a little silver box with a bow on top. I wrote that out as my Christmas message, sent it out to all the people I usually send to at Christmas. And one letter I got back was the most touching to me of all because it's from my Aunt Jean. Aunt Jean has never been noted for dropping silver boxes. Aunt Jean always has instructions for people. She has the gift of correction. And I received a letter back from her after Christmas, and it said, I loved your message on the silver boxes. And then it said in here, I realized that you three children, meaning myself and my two brothers, that you three children are the silver boxes with bows on top that your mother left to me. I cried when I read that. I thought this little message on the silver box has touched Aunt Jean. Aunt Jean says, I am her silver box with a bow on top. She never said that to me before. I never heard any such words from her. I've been amazed at what talking about little silver boxes has done. One lady wrote me a letter and she said, I've started a silver box ministry in my church. I didn't know what a silver box ministry was. She said, what I've done, she said, I asked the youth pastor, are there any teenagers in this church that have got any problems? Is there a question? Are there any teenagers in this church have any problems? She said, the youth pastor gives me names every Sunday of young people he knows that are discouraged, brokenhearted, whose parents are getting a divorce, who have gotten themselves in some trouble. And she said, I write silver box letters to them every week, anonymously, and I just sign it, the silver box lady. Give them to the youth pastor, and he gives them out to the right people. Gives me new names next week, and I send them out. And she said, now people, the young people in church, are talking. Have you gotten a letter from the silver box lady? She said, nobody knows who I am. How exciting it is. Another lady wrote me a letter, and she said, I grew up with, and I love this phrase, she said, I grew up with a negative-mouthed mother. Isn't that good? A negative-mouthed mother. How many of us had negative-mouthed mothers knocking blocks down every day? And she said, I vowed I would never do that. But she said, after I heard your message on the silver boxes, I began to realize that I was saying things that sounded just like my mother. She said, thank you for reminding me. I'm going to try now to give out silver boxes with bows on top. As a speaker, it's important for me that I don't teach you anything that I haven't worked through in my own life. I'm not one who just gathers material from someone else and gives you platitudes. If I haven't lived it, if I haven't felt it, I won't share it with you. I've felt this. This has made a difference in my life. Just the last year and a half that I've been working with this little concept off and on, it's made a difference to me. It's made me measure my words in a different way. I began to think back, and I said to myself, how have you spoken to your children? And as I thought about it, I realized that it was easy for me to give silver boxes to my daughter, Marita. She and I have always agreed on everything. She's so much fun. She's just a laugh a minute. And if I ever feel discouraged or disheartened, my husband knows all he has to do is dial Marita and hand me the phone, and life brightens up for me. No trouble giving silver boxes to Marita. Some of you may have a Marita. You may have a daughter or a son that just the sight of them lightens your life, makes you say good words, encourages you. It was not hard for me to give silver boxes to Lauren. She always did everything right. Lauren's very choleric and strong, and she's done it the right way. She always knew just how it should be done, and she marched ahead and she did it. Now, sometimes she was telling me what to do along the process, but it was easy to thank her and encourage her because she was doing it right. Now, you might say, isn't that wonderful? She's had these two perfect children. But now I have an adopted son. Adopted son Fred is nothing like me at all. He and I have never had two thoughts in our entire lifetime that coordinated. When I would say to my daughters, run, they would run. I'd say to him, run, he'd stop. He never seemed to want to do what I wanted him to do. He said to me one day, it amazes me that people pay money to hear you talk. That is not a silver box. And I began to think about what had I said to him. It's amazing how usually they're reflecting in a way what we're giving. And if we're not giving out silver boxes, chances are they're not giving them back to us. So I thought about it. And I remembered one day when he came home and he said to me, Mrs. Johnson said that I have a charming personality. Now, I don't know what you parents would have said, but before I even had a hesitation for a moment, I shot out with the comment, I'd sure like to see some of that charm around here. Now, when you put that in the context of the silver box, Mrs. Johnson had given Fred a silver box. And what had I done? I'd taken it away. I'd thrown away the silver box. It was gone. I'd wiped out everything Mrs. Johnson had said. I, as the mother, had taken away the praise he'd received. I thought, it's a two-way street. He hasn't said anything too nice to me, but I can understand. I haven't said anything too nice to him either. A couple years ago, I had an opportunity to go to Europe and to speak. And I had to speak every other night, and for that, I got a three-week free trip to Europe and the Holy Land. Sounded great to me. So I was all set to go, and they said, you can bring someone else with you if you'd like. It'll only cost the airfare. We'll take care of everything else. So naturally, I assumed my husband would go. At that time, he was unable to leave for 3 weeks. I thought, well, I'll take Marita. She and I will laugh our way through Europe. There's always funny people on those tours. You know that. They're all peculiar except you. And so you look at these people, and I thought, Marita and I can laugh our way through Europe. We'll have a good time. But Marita just got married. I couldn't take her away for 3 weeks, so I couldn't take Marita. I thought, well, Lauren will charge me through Europe. We'll go up and down through every cathedral, every castle. We'll have a wild time marching through Europe to Lauren's drumbeat. And I figured, that'll be good. I'll take Lauren. But Lauren just had a baby. Couldn't take Lauren. So what did it narrow it down to? Young Fred. I prayed about it, and I said, Lord, surely you're not saying to me to take Fred to Europe. Fred doesn't want to sit and look at me for 3 hours. He certainly doesn't want to sit and look at me for 3 weeks. But the more I prayed about it, the more the Lord said to me, ask your son Fred. So I didn't want to, and I'm sure some of you have done prayers like this. And I said, Lord, I will ask him, but you know that he will say no. I was helping the Lord tell Fred to say no. And so I went to him one day, and I phrased it this way. I said, Fred, I have this heavy trip I've got to take. Got laden down immediately in repeating it. And I said, I need someone to go along to carry the luggage and to move my suitcases and to set up in the rooms where I'll be speaking. I made this trip sound so negative that there's not one of you in this room that would have wanted to go with me. I got all through, and he smiled, which is unusual, and he said to me, I'd really like to go. And I was absolutely amazed at that. I thought, how could he have taken this sales pitch? I'd forgotten that he was melancholy and that melancholies like things that are negatively presented. If I told him it was going to be a lot of laughs, he wouldn't have gone. So he said he'd go. Well, I prayed a lot before I went. I said, Lord, give me the wisdom to know how to handle this. I hadn't come up with a silver box idea at that time. I'm just looking at it in retrospect, and I realized that I had to pray to be able to figure out how I could spend 3 weeks sitting the same seat in the airplane, same seat in the buses, same room every night, and that we could have a positive time. And I realized, and we parents sometimes don't realize this, that it is not my responsibility to change that child to be like me. But it's my responsibility as the adult with the wisdom and the spirituality and the control. It's my job to adjust to him. I was not sent here by God to manipulate and control his personality. But I can learn to get along with him. I can get along with difficult people. So I realized that at the time and prayed that I'd be able to do that. It wasn't over anything. So I would say, come on, Fred, get out of the bus. We're going through another cathedral. And I would say this as upbeat and positive as I could say. And he would say to me, I don't want to see another cathedral. And I said, oh, really? And that's my main thought at that time would have been, humanly speaking, that I would have said, listen, Fred, do you know how much money it costs me to bring you over here? The more cathedrals that you march through, the cheaper it is per capita, per cathedral for me. That's what I thought of saying. But then I realized, no, that's not going to do it. So I just said, all right, Fred, stay in the bus. He stayed in the bus through many cathedrals. I brought him back postcards and brochures, and he had a whole stack of brochures by the end of the trip. We drove through the Alps, and I woke him up, and I said, Fred, these are the Alps. He opened his eyes, he looked out the side of the bus across the front and down this side and went back to sleep. I said, Fred, I told you these are the Alps. He said, I know, I just saw them. He works under the assumption you've seen one Alp, you've seen them all. He never did get with the trip. I didn't think he ever enjoyed it much, but the interesting thing is that we had this girl that was following us around on our group and the tour, and she was taking pictures of me. She took pictures of me in ungainly positions, such as leaning over the water coolers from the rear. She took pictures of me that were not positive, and I was not too thrilled with this girl, but one day she came up to me and she said, your son really loves you. I looked at her and I said, he does. She said, yes. I said, how? Tell me, what did he say? Now, I expected this girl to give a whole list of wonderful things. I thought, the Lord has finally revealed to this child the glories of his mother. And he's told this girl, and she's now going to tell them back to me. So I got all happy. I'm waiting to hear all these good compliments. And she said, well, yesterday, when we were going through the countryside on the bus, she says, you fell asleep. Now, that was unusual, but she said, you fell asleep. She says, your head was leaning over against the window. Your mouth was open. You looked real funny. So I took my camera out. She says, I focused it right on you. She says, across the aisle on the bus, and I focused on you. She says, I was just ready to take your picture, just about to click it. And she said, your son moved his whole body right in front of you. And she said, he stared at me, and he said, what are you planning to do? She said, I'm going to take a picture of your mother looking funny like that. And she said, he looked at me, and he said, from here on, you will take no pictures of my mother without asking her permission. And then she looked at me and said, your son really loves you. Now, that was worth the whole trip to me. And the amazing thing is, even though it wasn't a list of great things, but what it said to me was, when the chips are down, my boy is on my side. What a good feeling to know that. He and I have had a different relationship ever since. And now he's able to take me to the airport and kiss me goodbye in front of the Skycaps, who are our friends. Because we live there. And he's able to do that without being ashamed. He's able to put his arm around me, and he can look me in the eye and say, Mother, I love you. He could never say that before. It's amazing how when you start giving out silver boxes, the response that you get back. I look back at my childhood, and I wondered, where did I get the affirmation? How did I go from being a child in three rooms behind a store without a ghost of a chance to amount to anything? Remembering the lady that looked at my two brothers and me during the Depression as we stood in the store, and as she looked at us, she said to my mother, it's a shame there's no hope for those children because they appear so bright. And that wasn't a silver box. But it was truth at the time. There was no money. There was no hope. And I remember that, and I remember saying to myself when I heard that lady, and I can picture her today and where she stood and what she looked like. I remember those words that knocked my blocks down. And I remember them, and I remember saying to myself, Florence, you'll show that lady. And I worked to get there, but I thought back, I thought, how did you do it? Who encouraged you? And as soon as I began to think about it, as you might begin to think about your childhood, I realized that even though my mother never gave me a lot of affirmation, and when I asked her why she didn't compliment me, she said, you never know when you're going to have to eat your words. Mother was always afraid she'd have to eat a few words. She felt it's better not to say any than to have to eat them. So I thought about it. I thought, well, where did I get my affirmation? And I realized I had a father who was affirming. I had a father who was constantly giving us positive words, who was positive every single day, who was lifting people up, who during the Depression in our little store, people would come to our store just to hear my father's encouraging words. And if they didn't have any money, he'd give them the food without it. He'd trust them for it. And we didn't have anything to spare, but he'd give it to them. I remember that. He gave encouraging words. That's why we had business. There was that old song, Home, Home on the Range with the Deer and the Antelope playing, where never was heard a discouraging word. And the skies were not cloudy all day. That's what happened in our little store. Even in dark times, my father kept it from being cloudy. I remember how my father trained us in words. He was born in England, and he loved words. I remember how he taught us things like people who live in transparent domiciles should refrain from hurling geological specimens promiscuously. I remember how when I was in kindergarten, he taught me in case the teacher asked me a question I didn't know the answer, I was to say, not knowing to any degree of accuracy, I dare not assert for fear of erring therein. I remembered some of the things my father had taught me. He'd given me encouraging words. He'd given me fast words. He'd taught all of us that if you could speak quickly and if you were sharp and if you had a good vocabulary and if you could handle your words well, that you'd always get jobs over people who mumbled. And he was right, because we all did that. So that I've earned my living on speaking. And my next brother has 4 degrees and is a minister himself, has been the outstanding chaplain in the Air Force. And my younger brother, Billboard, chosen as the most outstanding radio personality in the United States. 2 months ago. We've all used words, and we've turned most of them into silver boxes. Silver boxes of encouragement for other people. There's no way my brother in Dallas could have spent 30 years every morning, 3 hours a morning, giving encouraging, upbeat words to the people of Dallas. Couldn't have done that for 30 years if my father hadn't trained us to do it. If my father hadn't made it natural for us to give out words of encouragement. Yes, you'll make it. You can do it. You'll get there. And when I went to college on a scholarship, I remember my father saying to me, Florence, you can make it. Encouraging words. Words that blew away all those clouds that showed me, yes, there was hope. I remember back to my senior year in college, and I came home at Christmas vacation. And my father, who was 72 at that time, he was 20 years older than my mother. And as I came home, he said to me one day, right after Christmas, Florence, come in the back room. I want to show you something. So I went into the back room with him. He never took me there. He never left out of the store. And we went back into this little tiny den, which was the only little haven we had, a little den with 2 pieces of furniture, a piano on one wall, and a couch on the other that opened up. And when you opened it up, you could sit on the end of the couch and play the piano. That's the size of the room. So here it was. You had wall-to-wall beds. And we went in there that day, and my father reached behind that piano. You know those upright pianos that have all the little holes in them? My father reached behind the piano, brought out this little box, little cigar box, and he opened it up. And I looked at it, and I said, what's that? He said, it's a box that I had, and I hid it away. And he said, somehow today I felt like showing you this box. And I looked in there, because I'm a curious person. If I'd known there was a box tucked away, I would have been looking at it. But I didn't know it was there. And he showed it to me. It was full of clippings. And I looked in there, they were newspaper clippings. And I said, what are these? He said, these are articles that I've written. I said, you can write? You see, my mother had always told me your father didn't have any education. You've got to get education so you can do better than your father. My mother had fed me words like that. So when my father said he'd written something, I was dumbfounded. I didn't know my father was very bright. And I looked at him, I said, you wrote these things? He said, yes. I said, why didn't you tell me you could write? It was almost like I deserved to know I had a smart father. Why hadn't he told me before? And I said, why didn't you tell me that? And he said, because your mother always said, because you don't have an education, you shouldn't try to write. What if you tried and it wasn't any good? We'd all be humiliated. My mother was always afraid we'd be humiliated. So she never encouraged us to do anything, to take any risks or any chances. So my father, he said, I knew I could write. He said, I knew inside of me there was an ability to write. So he said, I would write when your mother was out. And I would write and I would send it into newspapers and I'd watch the newspaper until it came out and then I'd cut it out. And I put them all in this box. And he said, somehow today, I wanted to give you the box. And I took that box and I looked through it. I couldn't believe all these things my father had written. Important things. And as I got to the bottom, there was a letter in there from the United States Senate. I always have been interested in politics. I've always been interested in personalities. And it was from Henry Cabot Lodge Sr. And I opened up this letter and it was to my father. And I said, what did Henry Cabot Lodge write you for? And he said, well, I wrote him a letter telling him how he should run his campaign better, more efficiently and effectively next time. And he said, because of that, He wrote me back a letter, and it was a personal letter, 2 pages typed. And it said, "Dear Walter Chapman," and then it went down. "This idea was very good. I will implement that in my next campaign. This idea I cannot use for this reason." And he enumerated everything, 2 pages, answering my father's letter, sharing with him what he liked about what he said and how he had thanked him and appreciated what he'd done for him. My father had written silver boxes to a senator, and he'd replied. I was so amazed. I put that back in the envelope, put all the clippings back in there. And I said to my father, let's put it back behind the piano. So we did. We put it back behind the piano. And I said, but I'll know it's there. As we left that little room to go back into the store, my father put his hand on my shoulder, and he looked at me. He said, "Florence, I think I tried for something too big this time." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I wrote into our denominational magazine, and I told them how they ought to change the way they chose the nominating committee for the national convention." Now, see, my father didn't write trivia. He cared. He had the big picture. And he said, "I wrote in and told them how they should do it differently." He said, "Good suggestions." And he said, "It's been 3 months now, and they haven't published it yet." And then he looked at me again, and he said, "Florence, I guess I've tried for something too big this time." Those were the last words my father ever said to me, because the next day, my mother and he took the first day off they'd had in 20 years. I stayed home and took care of the store with my 2 brothers. My mother and father went into Boston at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walking through the subway station in Park Street in Boston. My father dropped to the pavement. My mother looked down. A nurse came through the crowd, knelt down, looked up at my mother and said, "He's dead." A priest came by out of the blue, knelt down and prayed over him and disappeared into the crowd. My mother stood for over an hour, straddled over his body, protecting him, knowing he was gone. My mother had married a man who was exactly the same age as her mother. She married from one father to another father. Her father had cared for her till she was 30 when she married her husband, who became my father. She'd gone from father to father, and suddenly my mother had no father to take care of her anymore. And when she came home, I found out that my cheering section was gone. She walked in the store that night, and my brothers and I looked up and said, "Where's Dad?" She said, "He's dead." She walked into the back room, went into that one little bedroom, shut the door. And she didn't come out that night. Well, all we knew was, "He's dead." We kept the store open till 11 o'clock, as we had every other night. I wonder now why, excepting, I guess, that we were just in a state of shock, and we just went through the routines. And people came in, and they'd say, "Where's the old man?" That's what they called him. I never liked that. I never liked the fact that people thought he was my grandfather. "Where's the old man?" And I said, "He's dead." And they'd say, "Oh, they'd pay for their things," and they'd leave. At the morning of the funeral, I was sitting in the store opening up the cards that had come. For those days, many cards had come because, you see, everyone loved my father because he gave them encouraging words. And as I opened up these cards of sympathy from all the people that came into our store, I noticed the magazine, our denominational magazine. I never would have looked at it at such a time except my father told me. I opened up that magazine and looked through it, and inside, there was my father's article. "For More Democracy, Walter Chapman." It came the day of the funeral. I'm so grateful today that my father showed me that box. Because, you see, I have those clippings. And I have framed on my wall at home, I have the article from that magazine and a picture of my father. And I also have the letter from Henry Cabot Lodge Sr. And I went back to Boston and I got a picture of him. And I have Henry Cabot Lodge and his letter and my father and his article. And I have those framed on the wall in my study so that every day as I pass by, I'll remember the value of an encouraging word. Because, you see, my father had a box of broken dreams. Things he could have been if only someone had encouraged him. One time I sat down with my husband's mother. We'd never had anything much to say to each other. She seemed to be a superior being. She seemed to be above everybody else. She was elegant and beautiful, said the right things, did the right things, had the big home, knew how to pour tea out of silver pots, all the things I never learned. I looked at her with envy all my life. I was afraid of her because she was so put together, because she knew how to do everything with such style and flair, and I wanted so much to do that. So I never really had a one-to-one conversation with her until this one night, just a number of years ago, when I sat with her in her living room, and I didn't know what to say to her, and I asked one of those trite questions. I said, "Mother, what was it like when you were young?" You know you're getting old when people ask you that. People start asking me that. My grandchildren, "Grammy, what was it like when you were young?" They think I knew Abraham Lincoln personally. So I asked my husband's mother, what was it like when you were young? Not knowing what I'd get for an answer, she said, oh. Immediately, she said, oh, I remember when I was in college, I had this boyfriend, and I was so in love with him, we were going to get married. And she went on telling me about this, and I looked at her wide-eyed. I'd never thought of my mother-in-law having a boyfriend. Somehow, it just didn't seem to make sense. And as I looked at her, and so I said to her, well, tell me about it, Mother. And she told me that she and he were going to get married, and when they graduated from college, and she graduated from Cornell when she was 19, and she said, when we graduated from college, we went two separate directions for the summer. He was going to call me in the fall, and we were going to get married. I said, well, what happened? She says, well, when the fall came, he never called me. She says, he never called. I looked at her. I said, you mean he never called you? She says, he never called. I never heard from him again. I said, well, what did you do? She says, well, I cried a lot. Tears came down her cheeks. I'd never seen my mother-in-law relaxed. I'd never seen her real. And you may have some person that you deal with that you know is not real. You've never really gotten in there behind who they appear to be, behind the wall they've built around themselves and for protection. I'd never noticed it or realized that was what it was. But as I talked to her, she cried and she said, he never called me, and my mother didn't like him anyway because he didn't come from a rich enough family. And her mother's theory always was, you can marry and fall in love with a rich man as well as a poor man. That was her family motto. She said, my mother didn't like him anyway. She said, after a while, my mother introduced me to Fred Littauer, and she said, I married him on the rebound. And then she looked at me and she said, I never was in love with him. This is Fred's father. And I looked at her and I said, you weren't? She said, no, I did the right things. I played my role. And she said, I had the five children. And I was the good wife. And as she said this, she is crying. And she said, but I never was in love with him. What did that make me feel about my mother-in-law that I'd been judgmental and negative about? That I thought this is a cold lady? I never knew she'd had a problem like that before. And I looked at her with a different feeling. And then she said, but that's not the end. She said, a couple of years ago, I went to a party. She's in her 70s then. She said, we went to this party. She said, I looked across the room, and there was this man standing there. And she said, I looked at him, and she said, he looked like that young man that I'd been so in love with. She said, I walked across the room to get a view so I could look at him. And she said, when I got near him, he turned, and he looked at me, and he said, you are Marita. And she said, I looked up at him and said, you're John. And she said, I started to talk with him as I looked at him and I said, would you answer me one question? Why did you never call? He said, he looked at me and he said, oh, I called many times. And each time I got your mother. And each time your mother said, she doesn't love you. She doesn't want to hear from you again. Please don't call. And he said, the last time I called, your mother said, she's engaged to marry someone else. Don't ever call again. She looked up at me and she said, in tears, my mother's words ruined my life. What a different feeling I had about my mother-in-law that day. How bad I felt for the judgment that I had put upon that lady in years past. How aloof I'd felt she was. How cold. How artificial. And all the time she was hiding a broken heart. I said to her, Mother, what would you have been if you could have been anything you wanted to be in your life? She said, oh, I would have been an opera singer. I said, an opera singer? I didn't even know you could sing. She said, that's because I've never sung since I got out of college. I said, did you sing before? She said, I majored in music. I'd never known that. Of course, I'd never asked her. She said, I majored in music. And she said, I wanted to be an opera star. I said, why didn't you go and do it? She said, because my mother said, there's no money in that. You'll never make it. You don't have enough talent. Come into the family business, and that way you'll be secure. That way you'll have money. And she said, so I gave up singing. And she said, but inside, I've always wanted to be an opera singer. I never knew that about her. I didn't know she had any hidden desires. And then she got up from the chair and she went down the hall. She came back with a box, a big suit box. She opened up the box. She pulled out some pictures. And in it was this picture. She said, I want you to see this picture. She said, this is a stage set. She said, because I want you to know that I did once have the lead in an opera. She said, it was my senior year in college. She says, here I am, right here in the center. She said, I'm that one in the wing chair. And she said, these are all the cast around me. She said, I had the lead in the opera. Now she gave it to me. She said, here, you take this picture. Your daughter's named after me. Give this to Marita. I want her to have it. I want her to know that her grandmother could have been something if she'd ever had the chance. if she'd ever had an encouraging word, if someone had given her a silver box. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, many of us die with the music still in us. Fred's mother died with the music still in her. My father died with the music still in him. Each one of them had a box of broken dreams, a box of clippings, a box of pictures, memories of what they'd done that no one knew about, that had never become fulfilled. Both of them died with the music still in them. During Fred's mother's latter years, when Fred and I went to visit her, her mind had totally left her. She could not communicate. She couldn't say a word. We had no idea whether she could hear what we were saying or not, whether she understood anything. She was unable to articulate a word. I asked the nurse one day when I was down visiting her in Miami here in Florida, and I said, does Mother ever talk? She said, no, she never says a word. And then she looked at me, she said, but that's the strangest thing, that every once in a while, she'll stand up and she'll sing opera. Oh, isn't it amazing what's still in our minds? Many times our minds have forgotten what our hearts still remembered. Her heart still wanted to be an opera singer. And the last night before she died, she stood up at the dinner table, and the nurse told us that she stood there and she sang opera. And she said when she'd finished, I clapped for her, and she held her hand, and she bowed, and she bowed. You see, the opera was still in her. And she said when I went in the next morning, she was asleep with her hands like this and a smile on her face. She died with the music still in her. In the Song of Solomon, it says, yes, the winter is past. The rains are over and done. The flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. Is there someone at home waiting for you to give them a season of singing? Is there someone there who is just waiting for a silver box, who's waiting for a word of encouragement from you? Yes, there may be somebody you know who has a song waiting to be sung. Perhaps who has a race waiting to be run. Maybe a piece waiting to be played. Perhaps a scene waiting to be staged. A tale waiting to be told, or a book waiting to be sold. A rhyme waiting to be read, or a speech waiting to be said. If you know such a person, don't let them die with the music still in.